and put it down with a straw. "Where are you from, por favor?" Nayeli asked.
"Colorado," she replied.
"But, ¿qué es la palabra? Original."
"Colorado."
They all looked at each other.
"My folks come from Durango," she finally said. "My husband's from Chihuahua."
Nayeli launched one of her famous smiles at the chef. He nodded at her and grinned back. The food came quickly. Nayeli's number three was chiles rellenos and beans. Tacho's machaca was watery, the eggs undercooked. The chef came out, wiping his hands on a white towel.
"Okay, amigos?"
"Yes," said Nayeli. "Gracias."
"Muy sabroso." Tacho lied to be polite.
"Speak English,"
the chef corrected.
"Okay,"
Tacho replied. "Buddy." He smiled to himself. This was a comedic masterpiece, in his opinion.
"Vacation?"
the chef asked.
"Not really," replied Nayeli.
"Not really? What then?"
"Work?"
Nayeli offered, not sure of what she was saying, wishing she had brought the dictionary with her. The chef put down the towel.
"Work,"
he said. He turned his bloodshot eyes to his wife.
"Work,"
he repeated.
"Gui Cain from Sinaloa," Tacho offered, exhausting his English for the day.
"Came? How?" Nayeli, thinking she was among paisanos, thinking she was part of a great story and an adventure, made the mistake of winking at the chef.
"You know."
"I know? What do I know?" She tipped her head charmingly.
"We came across."
The chef glared at her.
"You're illegals."
"Pues," Tacho started to say, but the chef cut him off.
"No," he said. "No, not here. You get out."
"Perdón?" Nayeli asked.
"What?"
said Tacho.
"You get out of here. Illegals. What about the rest of us? What about us, cabrones? I came here legally. You hear that? Legal. You criminals come in here, make me look bad. I'm sorry, but you have to leave. Get out."
He was trembling with rage. He waved his hands. His wife called, "You better go now."
"It's hard enough," he was shouting. "I kill myself, and you, get out."
They hung their heads and rushed out the door, their faces burning with shame. They ran as fast as they could to the van and slammed the doors and locked them and trembled inside, and both of them cried because they were so lost and confused. The river never slowed. They were not amused by Fruita. Nayeli kept trying to pronounce it in Spanish.
Fruita.
Parachute failed to intrigue them. The Book Cliffs, the Rowan Cliffs, and mighty Battlement Mesa tried to amaze them, but Tacho and Nayeli were blind with shock and embarrassment. The land itself seemed to rebuke them. Every car that passed, they were sure, was dense with curses and accusations. Wisely, Tacho pulled off at Rifle for Eskimo pies and a visit to the trading post. Nayeli, caught up in patriotic guilt, bought a silver plastic rendering of the Twin Towers and mounted it on the dashboard. She attached an American flag decal to the windshield. Tacho bought a T-shirt with a picture of armed Apache warriors on it. It said, "Homeland Security since 1492. It never crossed his mind that Geronimo and his warriors would have killed him in a second.
Chapter 29
Chava Chavarin polished his best loafers for the fifth time. He spit on the leather and took a chamois to the uppers. He uncapped a shoe polish roller and carefully colored the edges of the soles. He made the heels look like new. He placed his shoes on folded newspapers on the table and let them dry. He tipped Quinsana foot powder into them so his feet would smell fresh. He chose white briefs fresh out of the package, and he pulled on long black nylon socks that rose well under his calves. He tugged on a snug white undershirt, which helped control his small paunch, tucking the undershirt into his skivvies before putting on a peach-colored cotton shirt with slight cream stripes. He had dry-cleaned a handsome pair of pleated pearl-gray slacks and added a brown belt with a faux gold coin buckle. His pocket handkerchief was also peach. Behind it, snug to his thigh, he inserted a gold money clip with 7 crisp 20s, 2 tens, 3 fives, and 10 new ones. His slimmest leather wallet went in his left back pocket. He had bought an Invicta Dragon Lupa watch from a television shopping network. It was massive. A watch Ronald Coleman himself might have worn, its magnifying crystal face making the thing look even more massive. His tie was off-white and picked up the thin stripes of his shirt. He at first rejected a tie clasp as too flashy, then decided a free-flying tie was simply too risque, debauched even. He clipped the tie with a fine gold scroll that spelled out Chava. A small shining zirconium was tucked in each A. Chava added a pale turquoise breast pocket hanky to the ensemble and regarded himself in the mirror. Nice, he whispered. Very nice. He spritzed himself with aqua velva. There. He was as ready as he would ever be. He combed his tiny mustache one last time. He made moochy lips at himself in the mirror. The mustache squirmed on his face like a caterpillar, as if it were 1961 again. He grabbed his keys and whistled some old sentimental favorites to build up his spirits. He locked the door and started downstairs, and only realized when his feet hit the grass outside that he'd forgotten to put on his shoes. He was all right driving to the hotel. It was another blue San Diego day. The glittering bay and the white sand and the gulls and the kites and the girls and the breeze in the palm trees. One white cloud hung above it all, like some sort of angel. Why, it was almost like Mazatlan, only better. Viva los United Estaites Norteamericanos! He felt a little shaky pulling into the Bahia Hotel's lot, imagining his mighty Irma watching him from a window. His lost Irma, queen of strikes, empress of the 7-10 split. Which room was hers? He parked and tried to rise from the car in one fluid motion, as if he were still dancing like he'd danced on those tropical nights so long ago, as if the years had not piled on him and tired him, as if his hairline were not thin and gray and flashing bright spots of light where the sun hit his scalp. He squared his shoulders and set his jacket and strode toward the doors, all the while feeling eyes, phantom eyes, burning into him from every direction. He maintained his splendid stride and positioned one flat hand before his belly like a blade, thus emphasizing the excellence of his slim physique. There was no one in the lobby. He boldly stepped to the desk and announced her name. The young man called her room and murmured to her. It was like a Humphrey Bogart mystery.
"Yes, ma'am," the young fellow said. He hung up the phone. "Room 227, he intoned.
Chava Chavarin slapped his fingers on the counter and grinned with less verve than he would have preferred. He turned, in sheer terror, and lurched toward the elevator. He tiptoed down the hall. There was still time, he promised himself, to leave. He could clear out his apartment in a matter of hours and head up the freeway to San Francisco. 219. 221. He smoothed his mustache again. 223. He coughed. 225. He needed to pee. 227. He stood there and shook himself, got ready to knock. The door burst open. Atomico bopped out.
¿Qué onda, güey? He said, and went on down the hall.
Irma called from within.
Chava? Is that you?
He stepped away from the door. He turned right, turned left, headed back toward the elevator. Atomico was standing there. He shooed Chava back toward the room with his hands.
I'd hit that nookie if I was you, Pops,
Atomico yawped. The elevator pinged. He got in.
Good luck, he said.
The doors closed.
Chava Chavarin, Irma's voice boomed. You come here this instant.
He turned. She stood in the doorway, 40 pounds heavier, dyed, in tight black stretch pants and a large red satin loose top.
Magnificent.
He smiled, took a step. She blushed.
Oh, my.
She giggled.
Oh, you've still got it, Chava.
His step lightened. He rolled up and bobbed down. He glided. When he got close enough to smell her lilac eau de toilette, he said,
Hello, my love.
She rushed back into her room. He followed. Quietly, he closed the door. Chapter 30. The next day, Nayeli and Tacho left Grand Junction and rose to Glenwood Springs. The mountains had teased them, stepping close and jumping away, until suddenly they were there, in all their dread and mass. The great Storm King brooding over the steaming hot springs, while a small wildfire worked the canyons behind the Burger King. Nayeli and Tacho sat on a cement table and watched the helicopters drop buckets of water on the thin line of flames. A group of metal chicks in black tees and wallet chains slurped milkshakes and smoked. They all looked upslope at the copters.
Hey, one of them called. You guys Pakistani?
Tacho shook his tail feather and said,
Mexican. Queer, too.
Wow, she replied, flicking some ash. Don't tell my dad that.
The helicopters whopped in the sky, their blades flickering silver in the sunlight.
How you liking that burger?
It's like God cook it, he enthused.
Dude, you're a riot.
Everyone basked in cross-cultural bonhomie.
Later,
the chicks called as they hove to their feet and shambled away. Tacho drove into Glenwood Canyon along the cantilevered freeway. To their right, the Colorado River surged green and cold, and across the river, a yellow locomotive pulled a train into the side of a cliff and vanished. Nayeli said,
Why do they call the river red when it's green?
It's the USA, Mora, he said. They do whatever they want.
Rafters bobbed along. Apparently, an avalanche had recently destroyed part of the elevated roadway. A road crew stopped the traffic. Tractors and trucks beeped and huffed. Far uphill, a guide vehicle began to lead the oncoming line of traffic along the single open lane. To their left, as they sat in the ticking traffic jam, Storm King and his minions formed a solid wall of rock. Aspens flounced all around them, peeking their heads above the sides of the highway. Their little yellow leaves, in the light, flashed like soft coins. Suddenly, a mayfly hatch burst out of the gorge, millions of mayflies. Gold, shimmering, they rose from the water of the Colorado in swirls, wafting like metallic snow blowing up into the sky. Silent. Nayeli could not stop laughing.
Look how beautiful, she cried. This is some kind of sign, no? God making a miracle for us.
A Native American in a hard hat waved them ahead. Tacho slowed and showed him his Apache Homeland Security t-shirt. The man gave him a thumbs up.
Yes, Tacho enthused.
They drove on, higher and higher. Nayeli could not breathe. They were too high. She had never been so high. It gave her a headache. Her lungs could not pull enough dry air into her body. It made her dizzy. Tacho grimly clutched the wheel and leaned into the climb, as if he could force the straining minivan to get up the increasingly impossible slope. But they hadn't seen anything yet. Ravens, hawks, eagles, deer beside the road. Evergreens took over from cottonwoods and aspens. Great lodgepole pines stood straight as spears. They topped off one of the many rises and beheld before them huge saffron valleys and ranges of mountains marching to infinity with vivid snow caps on their points. The sky was fractured in great blocks of cloud, chunks of white, blue, orange, violet. Nayeli gasped. She began to cry upon sight of it.
Is it always like this?
She asked no one in particular. Suddenly, Tacho shrieked,
Oh my God, mountain goats!
There they were, three cranky little mountain goats, off-white and dirty, their beards bobbing, as they munched roadside flowers and pondered the passing cars. At the Frisco rest area, they peed madly and were ambushed by marmots. Nayeli thought they were beavers. She opened a packet of Twinkies and was about to eat one when a camp robber bird dive-bombed her and stole the treat and flew away. The thief was immediately chased by two immense magpies, looking like black and white cows in the sky.
What is this? Tacho said. The Garden of Eden?
The Eisenhower Tunnel waited for them at 11,015 feet. The Continental Divide. Turn lights on in tunnel.
Un tunnel?
Nayeli asked. Tacho pulled on the lights, and they plunged in. But it was well lit, tiled as handsomely as a restroom.
Ooh, he said, scary.
Idiots in front of them and behind them started honking their horns to hear the echo. So did Tacho. Nayeli powered down her window and hollered,
Aua! She cried.
They burst out and were hit by sun as heavy as a bomb.
Holy crap! Tacho noted.
Watered veils of cottonwoods and aspens and houses with colorful wooden trim. Down, down, Tacho had to put it in low so he didn't fry the brakes. Buffalo Overlook.
Look at that sign, Nayeli cried.
Buffalo Bill's grave.
Quién?
Tacho asked.
Nayeli shrugged. Buffalo, Buffalo! She shouted.
Tacho sighed. Dad had to keep the kids happy and pulled over. They parked and got out, and there it was. The Buffalo Bill Buffalo herd. Monsters all. Wise-looking with their great beards and foul-stinking humps. Nayeli hung on the chain link. The beasts ignored Tacho's kissy noises and moved along the grassy hillside like languid tugboats in a harbor. A blue jay scolded Nayeli as she collected pine cones from the gravel. Tacho noted, "Here, even the birds hate Mexicans." It was dusk before they knew it. And cold. Indeed, Nayeli could not believe how cold it was.
"I'm shivering," she said.
It was a first. Tacho fiddled with the knobs until hot air jetted out from the dashboard.
"Look!"
Her arms were covered with goosebumps. Frankly, Tacho could not see what Nayeli found so charming about freezing your ass off. They found a motel on a dark purple defile in the mountain foothills near Golden, and they booked themselves as Mr. and Mrs. Vincente Fox. The friendly woman at the desk offered them each an orange. The office was in the living room of her unit. Behind her, they could see an old man with an oxygen tank staring at the flickering light of a television set. The office smelled like tuna casserole. A small hand-lettered sign on the wall said, "If you died tonight, do you know where you'd go?"
"Where are you kids headed?" the woman asked.
"Estes," said Nayeli. "Is right? Estes?"
The woman smiled.
"I bet you never saw nothing like Estes Park in Iraq," she bellowed. "Papa!" she called to her old man. "These Iraqi kids is going up to Estes Park."
"That right," he muttered. He waved one white hand. "Bless your hearts," he said.
"He's real sweet," the lady confided.
They went down the road and filled the tank at a BP station. Nayeli bought sandwiches, cookies, Fritos, and Cokes in the food mart. Tacho was miserable and freezing and tired. He drove back to the motel in a sulk and rushed into room 113 and ran himself a hot bath. Nayeli ate her sub and watched Jack Sparrow on HBO. Her father was still a million miles away.
"Thank you for driving me," Nayeli said.
"Don't mention it," Tacho replied. They followed Matt's directions. They skirted the front range of the Rocky Mountains without knowing the name of the mountain range they were seeing. Nayeli thought of it as the Sierra Madre. Tacho thought of it as the mountains. They didn't care for Boulder. Too much traffic. Too many skinny people jogging in ridiculous clothes. At Lyons, they turned up the mountains and again found themselves climbing among vast spikes of pines, dark, nearly black. Bright, pale granite upthrusts. Butterflies burst from the weeds beside the precipitous highway like little scraps of paper. Everywhere, relentlessly, crows. Nayeli had never seen glaciers. Again, her head ached, and she had trouble breathing, as if she had just run up a staircase.
"Waterfall!" she cried over and over.
The Rockies, apparently, never ran out of little waterfalls. Just when they thought they would never get there, they swooped down a great curve to the left. Before and below them, a great valley rimmed by brilliantly snowy peaks. In the heart of the valley, a turquoise lake.
Nayeli caught what breath she had left.
Yola once made her read a translation of Heidi, and this big valley in the mountains looked like the paintings in that tattered old book. Just for a moment, she thought what almost every traveler on that road thinks when they break through the pines and behold the great vista before them. I will live here. In the valley, the lawns along the edges of the lake were crowded with great shaggy animals that looked like horses with antlers.
Can we pull over? Nayeli, the nature girl, asked. What are they? She wondered.
Tacho's butt hurt. He was bored. Mountains, he thought. Motels. Big ugly deer. Gringos. He wondered who was running his restaurant now that Irma was in San Diego. He wondered if the great iguana was lurking inside his shelves.
They're robots, he said, put there to lure suckers into town.
He was delighted to say to himself, bitch. Nayeli jumped out and instantly regretted it. She was freezing. The icy wind dropped off the snowy peaks and raced over the choppy water of the lake. The big animals ate grass. She could hear their teeth working. They were magnificent. A sole fisherman stood on the edge of the water, ignoring her and the beasts. He wore a big army coat, and he had a gnarly beard and a nose burned a few thousand times by the sun. He turned his head.
Hello, she called.
He eyed her.
How do? He grunted.
Reeled in some line and cast again.
Please, she called. What is? What are?
She pointed at the beasties.
Ain't you cold, sweetheart? The man replied.
Yes.
There went that smile. She pulled it down, but it sprung back up. He smiled back. That was some cute senorita, he told himself. He set his pole against rocks, walked to his truck, and fished out a hoodie sweatshirt.
Come here, he said. I won't bite you.
She glanced at the minivan. Tacho seemed to be asleep. She cautiously came to the big man.
Here, he said. Put that on for you dive cold.
He tossed it to her. She pulled it on. It said Steamboat Springs on the chest. Search and rescue. There was a painting of a Saint Bernard on the front of it. The hoodie's hem fell to her knees. She had to bunch up the cuffs. To the fisherman, she looked like some kind of elf.
Gracias, she said.
De nada, he surprised her by saying. And don't say I never gave you nothing.
This seemed to amuse him. She pointed to the animals.
Please?
Them's elk.
Elk?
Uh-huh.
She rushed to the van and checked her book.
Alce.
She had not ever heard of an alce, even in Spanish.
Son magnificos,
she said to the fisherman when she came back.
Good eatin', he said. Marinate you an elk steak and wild blueberries for a night, then grill it. Oh, yes.
In less than 10 minutes, he was teaching her how to fish. He showed her where the eagles came down to the water from the cliffs. He told her how condors had been seen there, too. How they'd probably snuck through the Rockies all the way from California. Somehow, she understood what he was saying. When it was time to go, he gave her a hug, and she kissed his cheek, and realized halfway across the big valley that she didn't even know his name. They drove to the main gate of Rocky Mountain National Park. The female ranger in the booth took Tacho's money. He just held out a sheaf of bills and said, "Please." She counted out the proper amount and handed him his change and a nifty map. Neither of them was ready for what they found inside the park. Insane peaks, more glaciers, more elk, eagles, deer. Tacho, nature-hater that he was, shrieked when he saw a bobcat sitting primly on top of a tall rock beside rushing water. "It's a robot," Nayeli reminded him. Rivers, waterfalls. They walked around Bear Lake. It was cold. There was nobody there. On the far side, under the peak of a bizarre boxy mountain, white flakes began to wobble out of the clouds. "Where did these feathers come from?" Tacho asked. Nayeli let out a cry. "Tacho, it's snow!" He said, "No, it isn't." But it was. They licked it out of the air, ran and screamed and jumped. Nayeli had never heard the world go so silent. Jays and magpies and camp robber birds muttered fretfully. She could hear the soft swish as the snow landed on the ground. Tacho had flakes on his long eyelashes. Nayeli took them off his eyes with her lips. They held hands as they walked back to the minivan. And as they drove down the mountains, she pulled the fisherman's hood up over her face and pretended to nap so Tacho wouldn't see her crying again. They plunged. They hit the flats. Denver, scary and confused, they didn't know if they were seeing roller coasters or factories. The minivan's engine started to make a faint clacking sound. Out into yellow and brown lands, into the lonely wind, across the emptiness of the high plains, to a courtyard motel on the Kansas border. The men in the next room pounded on the wall if they talked too loud or laughed. Nayeli found a praying mantis on the wall outside their door, studying the moths coming to the light. They were afraid of the neighbors, so they whispered and decided not to turn on the television. In the morning, they were blinded by wind. Grit stung their eyes. They swerved and rocked as Tacho tried to navigate the buffeting gusts. A semi-trailer rig had blown over on a cloverleaf onto I-70. It lay on its side. No one was visible for miles. They pulled off for gas at a place called Canarado. Nayeli kept the fisherman's hood up, but the wind sliced through her clothes like scissors. A state trooper pulled up to the pumps just as a siren on a pole started to howl. "Come on," he shouted, "tornado warning." They trotted into the small food shop behind him, and everybody hunkered down and drank burned coffee. "She's blown up a Whistler," somebody said. The cop said, "Driving somewhere?"
"Kankakee, Illinois," Nayeli explained.
"Huh, how about that?"
He turned to the woman who worked in the shop.
"Vicky, how about that? A working American can't afford to gas up his rig, but the illegals can just drive cross-country all they want."
When nothing tornadic happened, they paid for their gas and drove away. Chapter 31. It was 9 a.m. In conference room 1A of the Bahia Hotel, the Pelican Room, Tia Irma's tribunal sat at the wide folding banquet table. The hotel workers,
two guys from Tamaulipas who had entered the U.S. just south of Ajo, Arizona on a cloudy night in 1998, set white paper tablecloths on the tribunal's table, and they brought Laosa plastic pitchers of water and a cauldron of coffee. Atomico could have just attached his mouth to the spigot, he guzzled so much of it.
"Oye, tía," he said, "can't you order some donuts? Maybe some pastry? Damn, don't be cheap."
To everyone's astonishment, she had the Tamaulipas boys bring in a tray of pastries and muffins. Atomico nearly gagged when he bit into a bran muffin.
"Bird food," he yowled.
However, when he discovered the exotic sublimity of cheese-filled Danish, he fell silent. Irma herself sat at the center of the table, a yellow legal pad before her, and an array of Bahia Hotel complimentary pens fanned out precisely on the cloth. To her right, the gleaming and suave Chava Chavarin, now deputy mayor of Tres Camarones, Sinaloa. He had gotten a shave at a barber shop, and his skin was tight and shiny. To her left, Yolo Xochitl. On the other side of Chava, La Vampi slumped in her seat and played with her hair. She was distracted. Atomico and El Brujo were the tribunal's security guards, and every time Vampi caught El Brujo's eye, she giggled and blushed. She wore a short skirt and brazenly flashed her panties at him. He scowled and shook his head. Atomico did not notice. He was licking frosting off his fingers so his mighty staff did not get sticky. In the corner, like bad boys in a sixth-grade class, Matt and Angel sat on folding chairs. Matt got himself a cup of coffee and wondered how Nayeli was doing on her trip. Good old Nayeli. Yolo, exercising her frightening Mexican woman's psychic love powers, turned and glared at him.
"Whoa, dude," Matt whispered to Angel. "She knows what I'm thinking."
"Stop thinking," Angel advised. Chava had put ads in several newspapers. Atomico and the boys had spread the news at taco shops and barrio stores. Nobody knew what would happen. Hipólito, one of the Tamaulipas boys, peeked in the room.
"Applicants," he said.
"Send them in," Tia Irma proclaimed.
Chava felt a thrill.
This was a moment for the history books. He nudged her knee under the table with his own.
Irma smiled. A small line of nervous men straggled in. 5, 6, 10. Some had hats. Atomico pointed at them with his staff and growled. They pulled off their caps, grinned sheepishly. 12. The door opened again. 13. It was getting crowded in the Pelican Room.
"We seek 7, Irma intoned. "Soldiers or policemen?"
The men murmured, "Yes or si."
"We have 3. Of you standing before me, I can only take 4 more."
The door opened. 14, 15, 16. Hipólito looked in and shook his head.
"What is it?" Irma called.
"Men," he shrugged.
"How many men?"
He looked out.
"Many."
Irma signaled Atomico.
"Yeah, boss," he said, and marched out to the lobby.
A line of men snaked out the door. The people at the front desk were perturbed.
"Brother," one of the men said, "take us back to Mexico."
"Please," said another.
The voices rose.
"It is too hard. We want to go home.
We just need jobs.
Can they promise us jobs? Maybe a house? Are there girls? I want a wife. Are there women I can marry? Can I bring my family? I want to move my mama from Durango. Will they let me bring her?
Ask the boss lady inside, muchachos, Atomiko announced. She's the chingona here.
I hear they got fishing down there, is that right? I miss dancing in the street, man. I miss bullfights.
Did you ever do fireworks on Independence Day?
Some of them started laughing. You guys got rodeos down there? How about bars?
What kind of work? Is there work for a meat cutter?
I'll drive the bus. You mean you'll ride a donkey?
They were all laughing now, jostling and slapping each other's backs.
What can you do, pendejo?
I don't know how to do a goddamn thing. Why do you think I came to Los Unaites?
Ay, buey.
The people at the front desk were on the phone, checking with management. Men were streaming in, flooding the hotel, clotting its passageways, crowding its corners.
Slow down, muchachos, Atomiko said. Slow down.
He held his staff up, as if to guide them through a dangerous cleft in the rocks.
Calma, he said. Soldiers and cops, soldiers and cops. Everybody else can go home.
He went back through the doors. Behind him, their voices rumbled and hummed. He grabbed a blueberry muffin and sniffed it.
What's this blue shit? He muttered to El Brujo.
He peeled off the paper and looked at La Osa.
Auntie, he said, the revolution has begun.
Chapter 32. They didn't know the history of the plains and prairies, and they didn't care. The world looked to them like a great roll of butcher paper had unfurled on a table. The land here was so vast and so empty that a bomb could have exploded and there wouldn't have been any echo. Gas stations had canopies 2 stories high. Trucks wobbled and grunted in the wind, their miniature puffs of diesel smoke rushing north. Nayeli felt as if they had stopped moving at all, that they were floating, and that the ground had started to roll, passing under them as they stood still. Unknown to them, a Mexican wind had blown up from Durango and battered them now as it rushed to Canada. Sinaloan rain pattered on Nayeli's window, smearing the taste of Tres Camarones down the glass in long worms as they sped.
"I don't like the sound of this engine," Tacho managed to say.
It was hard to talk. They felt tiny and exhausted. Nayeli started to say something, but her mouth didn't want to open. She couldn't stop fretting about her father. Other thoughts were crowded out of her mind. The road from Canarado to the Brewster exit was only about 40 miles, but it felt like 1,000. Nayeli was feeling that old slide in her belly, that heavy, slow alarm, and she was bloated, crampy. They passed Mingo. Signs appeared. 6-legged calf. Cow with 2 heads. 6,000-pound prairie dog.
¿Qué es un prairie dog? Tacho asked.
Nayeli worked her dictionary.
Not in here, she said. A dog? Of La Padera?
He drove.
But 6,000 pounds, he said.
She felt the bite of a fresh cramp.
Tachito, she said. Papito?
Yes.
I need to stop, Tachito.
Stop for what?
I have my little problem coming.
She patted her abdomen.
Ah, that, he shook his head. Again.
Don't be mean to me. I'm delicate.
I'm not mean, girl. And you're as delicate as a brick.
She looked out the window. Maybe sometimes I want to be delicate, Tacho. He looked sideways at her. He reached over and squeezed her hand.
Bull with six legs, Oakley, Kansas.
Let's stop there, my sweet little apple pie, he crooned.
Oddly, he was too embarrassed to make a joke. They'll have it, you know.
She smiled. Gracias, she said.
In the gas station's food mart, he discovered corn nuts while she took her purchases to the bathroom. He bought 4 bags of corn nuts and a violently pink and purple gob of pureed ice called a slushy. He was overjoyed to be alive.
Where is, he asked the silent woman behind the counter, giant pradera dog?
What?
6,000-pound dog of the pradera?
What dog?
Please, the signs say 6,000 pounds of dog, of the pradera.
The woman said, oh, the big giant prairie dog. She leaned forward. It's a lie. It's made of cement.
Tacho stood there, slurping his slushy. Suddenly, he put it down.
Ay, he said, my head! Brain freeze, a trucker explained. The woman nodded. Honey, you got brain freeze. It's the slushy, partner, the trucker nodded.
Aye! Tacho went out to the minivan and massaged his forehead. Nayeli jumped in and said, just in time.
She was baffled when he announced, it is all a cruel illusion. Still, he drove down to the prairie dog village. Old cars were parked in the lot, so he figured it was a popular stop. When he parked, he noticed grass growing around their tires. They were derelicts.
Interesting, Nayeli said.
Lures, Tacho realized. They use empty cars to fool tourists.
Like it's a really busy place, Nayeli noted, trying to crack a corn nut with her teeth.
Maybe they eat people who come inside, Tacho said. Oh boy, I can't wait. They walked in. The shop was chock full of mementos and gewgaws. A man sat at the far end of the room. He smiled at them, waved, and took up a stick.
Want to hear the rattlesnakes? He asked.
Excuse? Said Nayeli.
He reached over to his right and banged on a big wooden box. Sizzling rattles rose from its mesh top.
50 rattlesnakes in there, the man confided.
Tacho crept to the box and looked in.
Guau, he offered.
The man said,
hey, you know what the cows do for fun on Saturday night?
Excuse?
It was Tacho's turn.
I say cows, son. What do cows do on Saturday night? For fun.
Tacho shrugged.
They go to the movies,
the man shouted. He laughed and sipped some coffee from a chipped mug.
Good one, right?
Right. Nayeli was amazed to discover that one shelf of souvenirs featured shellacked chunks of horse feces with little google eyes stuck on them. They stood on wire legs with plastic feet. Some of them were playing golf with wire clubs. One strummed a guitar. The handmade sign said, Original Handmade Turdy Birdies. Tacho pulled back onto the freeway and rolled on into the brown glare of the flat horizon.
Kinter, Voda, Ogala, Hayes. They were weeping with boredom and despair. Grain elevators looked like 170-story science fiction towers from 10 miles away. Selina.
Otra vez, Selina? Tacho complained. Weren't we just in, Selina?
Before them, a vast smear of smoke. Not smoke. Birds. Aloft. Suddenly, as one, they turned, vanishing in the air like the louvers of God's own opening window blinds. Appeared, vanished. Appeared. Swept away to stubbled fields. They clattered to a stop in Topeka. They felt like they had sandpaper in their shorts, old glue in their mouths. They rented a room in a motel run by a Punjabi family. They signed in as Mr. P. Villa and Mrs. S. Hayak. They avoided the eyes of strangers. They sat next to a black family at an early showing of a $3 movie about a woman named Madea. They walked back to the motel, and Tacha went next door to buy a sack of tacos. Nayeli found crumpled, soiled tissues under her bed. "Another day in paradise," Tacho said. They passed through Kansas City, crossed the state line, and were alarmed to find themselves in Kansas City. Tacho thought he'd driven in a circle. They shot out the far side and banged along, heading east. Missouri, at least, offered some hills. The car's engine was now whining as well as clanging. Tacho felt queasy. "This trip," Tacho said, "forgive me, but it's torture."
"I'm sorry."
She felt weepy. "Oh, spare me the waterworks," Tacho thought, surreptitiously wiping a tear from his own eye. They were far from anything they knew. They were far from any world they could understand. They were naked. "You did this to me." They came in view of St. Louis. The arch terrified them for a second. It looked like an alien force, a terrible metal presence looming over the panicked mortals. Tacho stared at it as they approached. Finally, he said, "Wow! Look at the size of that arch! That must be McDonald's World Headquarters." He had to stop for the Mississippi. They walked around the base of the arch, frightened of it, as if it were a giant robot from a bad monster movie. Rangers in their smoky bear hats looked like Border Patrol agents. Families ate funnel cakes. "Fat churros?" Nayeli asked. They stood at the edge of the Mississippi and beheld its deceptively slow-looking brown water, the scaly old boat across the river, the stained cement walls of the banks, the grinding train on the far side. A single duck muscled futilely against the current, gave up with a squawk, turned around, and shot downstream. Tacho felt sharp pinpricks in his gut, said nothing. But he told Nayeli when she bent down to a drinking fountain, "Don't drink the water." He could already tell he was in for a bout of Washington's revenge. Pepto-Bismol, 7-Up, Subway sandwiches and yogurt in a motel somewhere near Vandalia, Illinois. The Subway guy had alarmed Tacho by confiding in him. "We got black UFOs down here a mile wide." "Tomorrow's the day," Tacho told Nayeli as they went to bed. He threw up his sandwich at midnight. Chapter 33 Tacho had a fever by the time they got to 57 North. His fingers felt like sausages, and his head felt swollen. He shivered. He stopped at gas station toilets and rest areas and was amazed he still had anything left in him. Ma Johnston's minivan, too, was sick. It screeched, banged, and clacked as they drove. When he shut off the engine, it fumed. And when he went to start it again, it coughed and groaned.
"Almost there, Tachito," Nayeli cooed. "Almost there. I'll put you in bed as soon as we get there. Don't worry, my father will take care of everything."
She kept up a stream of heroic and uplifting chatter, but all he did was moan. Tacho didn't believe any of it. She didn't believe her father was even in Kankakee. They were fools on a fool's errand. They had been fools to ever leave Tres Camarones, and they had joined all the other unwanted fools hiding in the long shadows of the United States. He thought he was going to Beverly Hills, and here he was in Cowpie Pradera. Turdy birdies, he thought. Nioga. Mattoon. What kinds of names were these? Arcola. He roused himself to say, "Arcola? Mearda la cola." She laughed. "Ay, Tacho." He had told her his ass was burning. Champagne. Rantoul. Freight rail lines ran along their left side the whole way. The sidetrack train cars looked to Nayeli like washed-up boats on the edge of a very wide sea. Abandoned semi-trailers stood at angles on the edges and berms of vast dead farms. The dark fields ran away from them until they vanished in the violet skies, nodding up and relentlessly stalking toward them from Iowa and Nebraska. Paxton, Onarga, Shabance.
"Chingado," Tacho cried. "Ya pues, where is this Kankakee, for God's sake? I'm through!"
"Soon, Tachito. You're doing great. Soon, you'll see."
And suddenly, they were crossing the Kankakee River.
"Look!" she yelled.